Welcome to The Love Booth and Other Plays, a play by Tara Goldstein with contributions from Alec Butler and Jenny Salisbury, and music and lyrics composed by Cale Reed. I am playwright Tara Goldstein, and I am so glad you've joined us. The Love Booth. The Love Booth celebrates the 50th anniversary of homosexuality being taken out of the American Psychology Association, APA's, Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM, in 1973. The DSM is the handbook used by healthcare professionals in the United States and much of the world as the authoritative guide to the diagnosis of mental disorders. In 1973, homosexuality was labeled an illness in the DSM, and that idea led to a variety of oppressive practices against people who identified as lesbian and gay. Activist Barbara Giddings, her partner Kay Lahusen, and Frank Kemeny started attending and disrupting meetings at APA conferences where psychiatrists were promoting brutal methods for curing people who identified as lesbian and gay. The first play in the set, The Love Booth, tells the story of their activism. Setting: the American Psychology Association Convention in Dallas, Texas, 1972. Scene 1, Mystery.
Welcome to the Love Booth, the only place in the entire American Psychology Association Convention where the word love appears. What does that tell you? This is my fourth APA convention. My first was in 1968, where I went undercover as a psychiatrist, a sheep in wolf's clothing, to learn about what psychiatrists were saying about people like me. I was outraged at what I heard. The psychiatrists wanted to get rid of us. They presented films on aversion therapy that were horrifying. And I knew right then and there, our top priority had to be overturning the APA's classification of homosexuals as crazies. The first time I went to see a psychiatrist myself, I was 17. It was 1949, and I wanted to find out if I was a lesbian. I had just begun my first year of university at Northwestern, just outside Chicago. I paid for the appointment out of my allowance.
So you're a freshman?
Yes.
And you've had some trouble?
Trouble? No trouble. But some people say I don't know if I am, but my girlfriend refuses to talk to me anymore because of what people are saying. I want to find out if it's true. I mean, how can other people know if I don't?
I want you to relax and tell me about your life. Give me the evidence of your life. When you're finished, I'll give you an answer.
It's not that I don't like boys, but in high school, I was always more interested in girls. When I graduated, I wanted to study drama, but my father said it cost too much, so...
Tell me about your father.
My father? He was a diplomat for the American Foreign Service. I was born in Vienna, my older sister in Riga. That's in Latvia, in Northern Europe. My brother was born in Prague, Czechoslovakia. When I was very small, my father was assigned to Berlin, and we lived there for a while. But then he left diplomatic service and we came back to the United States. My mother says when he came back to the States, he became very religious.
Was your mother religious too?
No, but she promised to raise us Catholics, so we were sent to a Catholic boarding school in Montreal, in Canada. But when the United States entered the war, my parents took us out of school and we moved to Wilmington, Delaware. For a while, I went to Catholic school there too. For a while, I wanted to become a nun. Anyway, I came to Northwestern and became friends with a girl. She's just a friend, but that's when the whispering started. And now she stays far away from me, as if we've done something wrong. Do you think I'm a homosexual?
You're definitely a homosexual.
Later, when I told this story to a friend of mine, she was furious. "That psychiatrist shouldn't have labeled you," she said. But I wasn't angry at all. I thought she did me a favor. She gave me an answer to my question. I never went back to her office. I didn't want her to try to cure me with psychotherapy that cost a lot of money. I was fine with what she told me. Now I knew who I was. I was a homosexual. But I had no idea what it meant to be a homosexual. It was a mystery. A mystery I needed to solve. I went looking for my people.
There's a mystery to be solved. She was trying to understand how something that felt so right could be so wrong in their eyes. And their whispers mystified her. Gossip can be a slow-moving flood tide, exposing the truth people already see. She went searching for clarity. She said, I don't need you to cure me or fix me. This label is enough for me. You see, you've done me a favor, Doc, and it feels fine by me. 'Cause there's a word for women like me, and it's funny how language can help us feel free. But now if you'll excuse me, I'm going looking for my people.
Scene 2, Daughters of Bilitis.
I started skipping classes and spending all my time in the library reading anything I could about homosexuals. I read books on abnormal psychology and books on the law. I read the encyclopedia and novels when I could find them. Of course, I read The Well of Loneliness, a tragic story very overwritten with, surprise, surprise, a very unhappy ending. Colette's stories about Claudine were much better. I decided to look for other women to talk about all the books I was reading. I started at the women's bars in New York City. Have you read Claudine à l'école? I found it at the Philadelphia Free Library.
You went all the way to Philadelphia to go to the library?
Look, it has drawings. Two women. One of them sitting on the lap of the other.
If you like sexy pictures, I've got sexier pictures than that at home.
It wasn't until I discovered the Daughters of Bilitis that I found my people. I know. Name's too long, too difficult to pronounce, too difficult to spell, and what the hell, Bilitis was a fictional character, not even a real person. It didn't matter. The group was made up of lesbians, had chapters across the country, and published a newsletter called The Ladder. It was typed on a typewriter, mimeographed, stapled, and sent through the mail in a brown paper bag. On the cover, there was a drawing of women moving toward a ladder that climbed into the clouds, showing the world that my people existed. There was a literature about us. I went to my first Daughters of Bilitis meeting in Los Angeles. It was the first time I had a chance to meet other lesbians in a place that wasn't a bar. They talked about writing, and they were part of a movement that I could join to fight against a system that told me I was sick. 2 years later, I launched the East Coast chapter of DOB in New York City and became its first president. It was 1958, 11 years before Stonewall.
Scene 3, Courage Against the Crowd.
I met Kay Tobin Lahusen in 1961 at a picnic for the Ladder in Rhode Island. I was 29. She was 31. She became the woman I would spend the rest of my life with.
Hello? Anybody home?
Yes. Hi. I'm Barbara. And you are?
Kay.
Kay, who works for the Christian Science Monitor.
Yes.
You're not what I expected.
Let me guess, you were expecting some mousy little old lady.
Yeah, kind of. Come in. We're all in the backyard. How was your drive?
Fine.
Where are you coming from?
Boston?
Well, thanks for making the trip. I invited everyone on the mailing list who lives within a 100-mile radius of Rhode Island. We want to start a chapter here.
How many people are coming?
12. For us, that's a really big turnout. But I need to warn you, we're kind of a motley crew.
Really?
Yeah. A little unconventional.
I'm okay with unconventional.
Me too.
By the time we were packing up the food and folding the picnic blankets, I knew I wouldn't have to leave Boston and go to Chicago or San Francisco to meet someone. After courting for a very short time, we settled into Barbara's apartment in Philadelphia and
we've been together in the gay cause ever since. We found out we had a lot in common. Like me, Kay comes from a religious family. Like me, she started asking questions when she was in university.
The summer after I graduated from high school, I met a girl who'd gone to the same school I had. We hadn't met before. I fell in love with her. She fell in love with me. She had a little experience and we began to have sex. I thought we had the world's greatest friendship. But then, after some time together, I realized we were more than friends. We were lovers. I was so taken aback. I had to go to bed and lie down. I was in bed for 2 weeks. My Christian Scientist grandparents arranged for someone to come to the house and pray over me. But of course, I couldn't tell them what was wrong, what was causing me such agony. And I couldn't turn to my lover because she wasn't the strong one. I was. So I healed myself. I decided that there wasn't anything wrong with our love. We were right and the world was wrong. It was 1948. I was 18. I followed my lover to Ohio State University. I was supposed to go to a small, wonderful liberal arts school, but her family couldn't afford to send her there, so I went where she went. We shared a room in the dorm. We were very careful. We weren't the only lesbians in the dorm. There was a butch femme couple who used to hold hands on the bus. One wore high heels and makeup. The other had short hair and wore boys' shirts and pants. The dorm mother caught the girls in bed one night, and the first person she told was my lover. "I found these girls," she said. "What should I do?" I can't remember what my lover told her, but I do remember she was very upset. She wouldn't touch me for 2 weeks. The whole thing was totally traumatic for us. The dorm mother ended up separating the girls into their own rooms. They were warned they would be tossed out if they were found together again. We weren't sure if they'd be tossed out of the dorms or tossed out of the school. It didn't matter. My lover and I decided never to go near them. Their cover was blown. We were lovers for 6 years, all through school and 2 years after that. But I knew she wanted to get married and have children. She came from a Jewish family who thought the purpose in life was to get married and have children. Not only that, she wanted to be Miss Wonderful in her community. She wanted people to look up to her. And that couldn't happen if she was a lousy lesbian, not in 1954. My lover didn't think there was anything wrong with us living together. But she didn't think we could have a good life together because we'd never be accepted into the world. We'd always be this separate little twosome off to the side without any friends. She was a lesbian, but didn't have the courage to go against the crowd. She met a guy she liked, and he liked her, and they got married. I never spoke to her again. I tore up every photo and threw them in the garbage. After the breakup, I moved to Boston to work for the Christian Science Monitor in the reference library doing research. I decided to research what interested me most in the world: homosexuality. The Christian Science Monitor filed homosexuality under vice. That got me. I started arguing with other staff about it. Of course, I didn't tell anyone I was gay. I pretended to argue as a purely intellectual exercise. I finally came out to a colleague who was also a Christian Scientist. "The reason I got so angry about all of this is because I think I might be homosexual."
"And so what if you are? I have a friend in California who's homosexual. He's doing fine. You know, the church is very culture-bound. It holds the beliefs of the general culture.
She was very affirming, but I wasn't sure how fine I'd be if I came out. So I continued doing research, looking for a psychiatrist who worked with women. I found one in New York City who had written a book about a lesbian he had treated and believed he had cured. I made an appointment to see him. It was 1961.
So, what brings you here?
I want to know what makes people homosexual.
That's not a simple question to answer.
I see. So how do I meet other women?
Well, that's why you're here. That's easy. Here, it's called The Ladder. It's published by the Daughters of Bilitis. They have an office here in New York. Call them up. Here's the phone number.
Thank you. That's all I need. We only talked for 10 minutes, but I wrote him a check for $20, the full hour. I felt wonderful, lifted to the skies. I wasn't ready to call DOB. I needed some time. But I drove back to Boston on a cloud. As soon as I got back to Boston, I read the newsletter. The women who wrote it were trying to improve things for lesbians. I could meet other lesbians by working with them. This was it. I could meet other women and improve things for gay people. I could join DOB and work with them until I found somebody. If I didn't find anybody in New York, I'd go to Chicago. If I didn't find anyone there, I'd go to San Francisco. I'd go wherever I had to. I'd do whatever it took. I wasn't going to go on living for years not finding anybody.
I was the one who got Kay's letter asking about joining. I told her I wasn't going to be at the next meeting because I was going to be in California, but that she should go anyway.
So I got in my car and drove to New York to the office DOB shared with the Mattachine Society, which was
a group for gay men.
We never liked the name. Too long, too difficult to pronounce, too difficult to spell, and
what the hell does Mattachine mean? We found out it was a medieval French word that described secret societies of mass male dancers who criticized the ruling kings and queens of their country.
Under the protection of masks. Anyway, I imagined the office would be a big place with a lot of people, but when I got there, it was tiny. There was only room for 10 people, but it didn't matter. Only 5 people showed up, including me.
As you might guess, coming out to meetings wasn't exactly a popular thing to do. Most gay people were just trying to blend in and pass and...
Anyway, when I walked through the door, I found myself in the spotlight. Everyone had been talking. What was the woman from the Christian Monitor in Boston going to look like? What was I going to be like? I showed up in slacks, but quickly learned I was expected to wear a skirt. The purpose of DOB was to get lesbians to jack themselves up. We always hated that. The idea lesbians had to put on a skirt and shape up and hold a job and go to work 9 to 5 and...
And make ourselves acceptable to the world, so...
So you could expect something of the world in return.
It just didn't sit well with us.
It was pointed at the ne'er-do-wells who would loll around in the gay bar all day long, but...
But we didn't know anyone like that. Most of us...
Most of us were wearing skirts that were already much too tight.
She soaked up everything, anything she could, devouring pages of library books, finding women to talk to in bars, but they fed her pickup lines and funny looks. Then she discovered the DOB in LA, a woman's club for poetry, they would say, but it wasn't really about poetry, 'cause they were going to change the course of history. Doing their part for the homophile cause, with chapters spreading far across the country. They were working on the ladder one day in a Rhode Island backyard. And they were clad in skirts and optimism. Kay arrived in slacks and her smile drew Barbara in. She had driven all the way from Boston, and not long after, they moved.
Scene 4, legitimizing our existence.
DOB was a women's organization whose goal was to promote the integration of the homosexual into society. No one ever used the word lesbian.
Instead, they used the word variant
And educating the variant was one of the purposes of the group. The others were educating the public to break down prejudices, proposing changes to laws that discriminate against gay people,
and participating in research projects that were supposed to expand the public's understandings of gay people.
DOB invited anyone who was willing to come to our meetings. Psychiatrists, religious leaders. Obviously, they turned out to be people who wanted us as penitents, clients, or patients. But we were grateful to have anyone pay attention to us. We accepted everything they said, no matter how homophobic it was. At the time, we thought it was important just to be mentioned, to break the taboo of silence around homosexuality. Anything that helped break the silence was important. When somebody with professional credentials came to talk to us at our meetings, that legitimized the existence of DOB. When we needed to approach other people with power, we could say, Dr. So-and-so or Reverend So-and-so has come to talk to us. The professionals made us less of a pariah to the people we needed. Legitimizing our existence was an act of activism.
But it didn't take us long to change our approach. Well before Stonewall, the consciousness in the gay movement changed. Frank Kemeny was the first to say it. We are the experts.
Scene 5, Equal.
Frank Kemeny had been a brilliant physicist and astronomer with the U.S. Army's MAP service. He was fired for being gay and went to court to get his job back. Frank was the first person in the U.S. to launch a civil rights claim based on sexual orientation. The brief he wrote himself went all the way to the Supreme Court.
In World War II, I didn't hesitate to fight the Germans with bullets in order to help preserve my rights and freedoms and liberties and those of others. It is ironic now I am fighting Americans with words in order to preserve some of those same rights, freedoms, and liberties for myself and others. Our government exists to protect and assist all of its citizens, not, as in the case of homosexuals, to harm, to victimize, and destroy them.
Frank lost. So he founded the Mattachine Society of Washington and began to work to make change. Mattachine grew and started a chapter in New York. They invited DOB to share their office. Frank's ideas changed how I viewed myself. When I joined DOB, I wanted to improve the bad conditions of life for gay people to make the inevitable more bearable. I never thought we could fight for a full and equal place in society. We began protesting in the streets. It was a time of so many important protests. There were Black civil rights marches all over the country, and of course, the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedoms. That's the one where Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech. The gay civil rights movement was not created in a vacuum. Gay activists participated in these protests and learned tactics from the Black civil rights pioneers.
Scene 6, The Love Booth.
We brought the fight to the American Psychological Association annual convention. The lives of gay people were under the thumb of psychiatry. The sickness label was an albatross around our neck. It infected all of our work on other issues. Anything we said on our behalf could be dismissed as, that's just your sickness talking. Sickness was used to justify discrimination in all kinds of places, but especially in employment. Brilliant people like Frank lost their jobs when their bosses found out that they were gay. So, 2 years ago, we started attending and disrupting meetings at APA, where psychiatrists were promoting some brutal methods for curing us. Incarceration in mental hospitals, lobotomies, and aversion therapy, where they showed you pictures of the wrong kind of sexual partner, gave you an electric shock, and then showed you pictures of a person you should like and played nice music to persuade you to change your choice of sexual partner. Even the less brutal methods, like psychotherapy, were based on the idea that homosexuality was bad for people, bad for society, and needed to be fixed.
We demanded that the psychiatrist stop talking about us and started talking with us.
Last year, APA met our demand. They sponsored a panel called Lifestyles of Non-Patient Homosexuals and asked Frank to be one of the panelists.
We called it Lifestyles of the Inpatient Homosexual.
It was the first time APA acknowledged that there were gay people who weren't in therapy and had no need for it. This year, we were given a booth in the exhibition hall. Our display is called Gay, Proud, and Healthy. The Homosexual Community Speaks. There are photos of real-life, happy-looking gay couples, essays written by people who've been hurt by their experiences with psychiatrists who tried to cure them, and a collection of psychiatric writings that challenges the idea that homosexuality is an illness. We thought it would be the psychiatric writing that would lead to the most discussion and debate. But it wasn't. It was the photos.
But do these relationships really work?
Of course they work. Why wouldn't they work?
My patients have very troubled lives. They're disconnected from their families and can't seem to find friends.
Well, it's hard to find friends when you have to hide who you are because everyone you know believes homosexuality is a sickness or a sin. You should come to a panel I'm speaking at tomorrow with my colleague Frank Kemeny. It's called Psychiatry, Friend or Foe to Homosexuals. Frank and I are going to dialogue with two psychiatrists who have the same questions you do.
Neither of the psychiatrists were gay. I didn't think that was right. APA was pitting two heterosexual psychiatrists against two gays. What we really needed was someone who was both.
The moderator of the session, Dr. Kent Robinson, agreed to add a gay psychiatrist if we could find one. We searched and searched, wrote letters, made phone calls, but no one was willing to come forward. Finally, Dr. John Fryer said he'd attend the panel if he could come in disguise and use a voice-distorting microphone.
Dr. H. Anonymous was born.
Scene 7, Dr. H. Anonymous.
The lecture hall was packed. I scanned the audience and recognized some people who'd come by the love booth to talk. When I caught their eye, one of them nodded back seriously. Two others looked away in embarrassment, but two others gave me a small wave and a smile of encouragement. I waved back. We had smuggled Dr. Anonymous into the hall through a back corridor, and he was waiting in a corner of the hall where he couldn't be seen. Dr. Robinson signaled it was time to begin, and the room became quiet. He welcomed everyone, introduced each of the panelists, explained each of us would be given 15 minutes to speak, and that there'd be time at the end of each presentation for one or two questions. He nodded in my direction, and all eyes turned on me. Before we begin, I'd like to introduce a fifth panelist. Doctor, would you join us? I'd like to introduce you to Dr. H. Anonymous. Dressed the way he is, in a mask, wig, and oversized tuxedo, because at APA, it is not safe for a gay psychiatrist to talk openly about his life. Dr. Anonymous, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Barbara Giddings. Thank you, Dr. Robinson. I'm a homosexual. I'm a psychiatrist. I, like most of you in this room, am a member of the APA, and I'm proud of that membership. I attempt tonight to speak for many of my fellow gay members of the APA, as well as for myself. We've somewhat glibly come to call ourselves the Gay PA, and several of us feel that it is time that real flesh and blood stand up before this organization and ask to be listened to and understood. I'm in disguise tonight in order that I might speak freely, without conjuring up too much regard on your part about who I happen to be. I do that mostly for your own protection. At least one of you has fired me because I'm gay. It's important for you to know that I could be any one of the more than 200 psychiatrists registered at this convention, and it doesn't matter if you know who I am. What matters is that you listen to what I have to say. As psychiatrists who are homosexual, we know what we must do to be successful. If our goal is a high academic appointment, a level of earning capacity equal to our colleagues, or admission to a psychoanalytic institute, we must make certain that no one in a position of power is aware of our sexual preference or our gender identity. We cannot be seen with our real friends, our real homosexual family, lest our secret be known and our doom sealed. There are practicing psychoanalysts among us who completed a training analysis without ever once mentioning their homosexuality to their analysts. As psychiatrists who are homosexual, we know we are required to be more healthy than our heterosexual colleagues. We know we have to make some attempt through therapy or analysis to work our problem out, and many of us who make that effort are still left with a sense of failure and persistence of the problem. As psychiatrists who are homosexual, we know what we must do in order to be successful. If our goal is a high academic appointment, a level of earning capacity equal to our colleagues, or admission to a psychoanalytic institute, we must make certain that no one in a position of power is aware of our sexual preference or our gender identity. We cannot be seen with our real friends, our real homosexual family, lest our secret be known and our doom sealed. There are practicing psychoanalysts among us who completed a training analysis without ever once mentioning their homosexuality to their analysts. As psychiatrists who are homosexual, we know we are required to be more healthy than our heterosexual colleagues. We know we have to make some sort of attempt through therapy or analysis to work our problem out, and many of us who make that effort are still left with a sense of failure and persistence of the problem. As psychiatrists who are homosexual, we know there is a lot of negative feeling in the gay community towards psychiatrists, and we know that we are easy targets on whom people are angry can vent their wrath. In our own hometowns, there is likely to be any number of patients or paraprofessionals who might try to hurt us if the communities they live in and work in enable them to hurt us. Finally, as psychiatrists who are homosexual, we seem to marry ourselves to institutions rather than wives or lovers. Many of us work 20 hours daily to protect the institutions that would literally chew us up and spit us out if they knew or chose to acknowledge the truth. These are our experiences. These are our feelings. And like any set of feelings, they have value only if they move us toward concrete action. Here, I speak primarily to the other members of the Gay PA, who are here tonight, although all of you are welcome to act on my words. When you are with fellow professionals who are denigrating the faggots, the queers, don't just stand idly by. And don't give up your career, either. Show a little creative ingenuity, and make sure that you let your associates know that they have a few issues which they have to think through again. When fellow homosexuals come to you for treatment, don't let your own problems get in your way. Develop creative ways to let the patients know that they're all right, and then teach them everything they need to know. Refer them to other sources of information with biases different from your own, so that they will freely be able to make their own choices. Finally, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and discover ways in which you, as homosexual psychiatrists, can be appropriately involved in movements which attempt to change the attitudes of both homosexuals and heterosexuals toward homosexuality. For if we don't change attitudes, all of us have something to lose. We may not be considered for that professorship. The analyst down the street may stop referring us his overflow. Our supervisor may ask us to take a leave of absence. I know I'm asking us to take a big risk. However, we are taking an even bigger risk by not living fully our humanity with all the lessons it has to teach all the other humans around us. We must, therefore, use our skills and wisdom to help each other to be comfortable with that little piece of humanity called homosexuality. Thank you.
Dr. Anonymous really rocked the audience. It was the first time any of them had ever heard a gay psychiatrist speak out. But the only way he could do it was masked, like a Mattachine.
Scene 8, Victory.
There were more eye-openers for the psychiatrist later in the convention. Frank took Philip Johnson, a gay activist from Dallas, as his date to the APA dinner dance. And when the band struck up a waltz, the two of them sailed out onto the dance floor. And what the hell? Everyone else pretended they didn't see.
Meanwhile, behind the scenes in APA, the wheels were already moving to consider taking homosexuality off the list of mental disorders as part of a general revision of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. But it was clear more education was needed, so we kept up a presence in the APA exhibit hall. In Miami in 1976, we did a display called Homophobia, Time for a Cure, with displays of materials illustrating anti-gay attitudes and policies and practices. Part of our prescription to cure homophobia was to include photos of happy, proud gay couples.
By 1976, gay psychiatrists had begun to come out of the closet and had created a gay, lesbian, bisexual caucus at APA. We made sure we had copies of caucus newsletters on hand at our booth. Our last APA exhibit was in Atlanta in 1978. We called it Gay Love, Good Medicine. Again, we featured photos of gay people, not as patients, but living happy and healthy lives. This time, I was able to get 5 gay psychiatrists willing to be in the exhibit with their photos and credentials. Quite a breakthrough.
They set their sights on the APA convention to break the silence and draw attention to the way their love was pathologized and their lies were delegitimized. But thanks to Frank, they quickly recognized that no psychiatrist could classify them. They were their own authorities. They were gay, proud, and healthy. They took control of the narrative and rewrote it from their own lived perspective. Turned that misdiagnosis on its head. Declared hatred the sickness instead. They were spreading gay love and good medicine to heal society's collective affliction. Devoting their struggle to me and you. Back then at the Love Booth.
The GLB caucus in APA was now taking steps to become an official subgroup of APA. A year later, the GLB caucus went fully public by taking part in the gay community's first national march on Washington.
The gay community's mental health improved dramatically when we spoke up for ourselves and took charge of our own destiny.
Dr. Fryer broke the silence about the harm psychiatry was inflicting on the gay community, and his words helped change the APA and the lives of countless people who no longer felt they needed to be cured of the feelings they had for the people they loved.
We had won a battle, but the fight wasn't over. There was still work to be done to liberate the stacks with the American Library Association. And though we didn't know it then, in about a decade, we'd be fighting for research to find a cure for AIDS.
But before that, we needed to elect a president who cared about our civil rights.
You've been listening to The Love Booth and Other Plays. For information about us, visit our website, www.gaileyrowe.com. Thank you.